Oh, thank you, Carol. She said, when they made the announcement that Ken wasn't going to be here, she leaned over to me and said, "It sucks to be you." My name is Phil. Phil In. I'm an alcoholic. Man, and there are so many people. My name is Joe Krogan. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Lee, and anybody who had anything to do with asking me to fill in for Ken. And I'm sorry that he is sick and he couldn't be here. And because when I heard who the illustrious speakers were here, I wanted to call in sick myself. I didn't know you could do that. But he wouldn't take my call. It's got one of those recordings on it. This is a call from an inmate. No. I'm really thrilled to be here, and I've got a lot of guys here from my home group and guys that I know who really came in expecting to hear Ken. And when they saw me here in a shirt and tie, they were like, "Oh my God." And you're right, we aren't very attractive. I'm like, we were a little bit late coming back, thanks to Bob and Linda. No. We had like 10 minutes. I go, "Hurry up, Tammy, I have got some panicking to do. Let's go." My lovely wife, Tammy, thank you. And as Bob always says, I'm well over married. It's really an honor to be here with the men that I absolutely admire. And I've been listening to you guys on CD. You've kept me company. You've kept me on the road. You beat the bushes and made a path for all of us in this room. And the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, here they are. Hi, Polly. My wife said, why did they give you step one? They should have given it to Clancy. And you need six and seven, so you get up there. All right. You know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love being here. It is a thrill. I mean, this is like the Super Bowl, to be here with these people. And you guys are the guys that are seeking this thing, and thank you. I hope you take some wonderful stuff back to your home groups. Take some enthusiasm and some joy back with you. I will tell you this. I drank a little. No, I drank a lot, actually. And I'm going to just take a sip here. Excuse me. I am nervous, but it's not that I shake a little bit. It's a side effect. I had open heart surgery about 5 years ago. And there's a couple side effects that I developed. One is that I get very emotional and I cry a lot. The other is I developed a tremor in my hand. So when I go to meetings in different places, they always think I'm the newcomer because I'm in the back of the room shaking and crying. And they'll go, "You just keep coming back, son." You know, I love that part that you read in there about Bill. I'm going to tell you a little bit. I am an alcoholic as described in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Did I forget to thank anybody? Did I do that? Too bad. Thank you. This is an incredible honor. I am an alcoholic, as I said, of the hopeless variety, as described in the Big Book. I don't know how you got here, and I know that they talk about the different types of alcoholic, and there's the alcoholic who's normal in every respect except for his drinking. That's not me. I'm the grave mental and emotional disorder alcoholic. My wife can fill you in afterwards. And she is the same. She's the one that's normal in every respect except for her drinking. And scored some points with you, did I? Okay. I didn't want to grow up to be an alcoholic. I you know, but I hear so many times. When I was a little kid, it's almost like when I looked in the mirror from as far back as I can remember, and I don't know what caused it. I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist. I'm not going to go there. All I know is that I had a sense of disapproval when I looked in the mirror. There was just something about me I didn't like. And if I just could be different, if I just had Rick's hair or Bob's nose, and if I had your parents, if I lived in your house, there was just something, and there was just this disapproval, this sense of, I like to call it a terminal sense of lack. And that's really, it affected me from as far back as I can. And because of that, I was always trying to, I was a victim of trying to please you and trying to do everything that you, you know, say and be what you expected me to be or wanted me to be. And that really, it got to be pretty cumbersome. And it's, you know, a lot of the dishonesty that goes along with that kind of lifestyle. But it gets to be pretty cumbersome until I was about 15, 16 years old and I took my first drink. And all of a sudden, everything fit. It was the magic. I've heard it over and over again in these rooms. For me, it was nothing less than a psychic change. It was nothing less than a spiritual experience. Absolutely fit in with you. It not only did it change the way it's like throwing darts at a dartboard. We try and describe it, but you can't describe it because it's spiritual. It truly is spiritual for us. We wouldn't chase it through the gates of insanity and death if it wasn't. And it was spiritual for me. It was the answer. It was the, oh my God, this is who I really am. Right? That's what happened to me. I became the guy I always wanted to be. I went from having a bit part to be the star of the movie overnight. And I always knew that I was going to be discovered. I figured somebody's going to discover. I didn't know for what, but I figured I'd be discovered sooner or later. And I proceeded to chase that magic, and it was back then. I'm a product of the 60s and 70s, and it was just partying. I'll tell you a great, I absolutely love, but I was like everybody else. I tried to control and enjoy my drinking. I always seemed to overshoot the mark. Did you have that problem? I would go out, I'm just going to get this far, but I would always go this far, and it would get ugly and nasty and sometimes messy. Over the years, and you know, I was one of the lucky alcoholics. I discovered there were some other things out there. I did some drugs, but it was only to help me control and enjoy my drinking. And if you're an old timer and you never did any drugs, too bad, it's too late. But I assure you, it was the alcohol that was my love, and it was the alcohol that was my first knee-jerk reaction, and I thought I was just partying, and you know, I was one of those guys. Some people can maintain and do things. From the moment I did it, it was, how do we do more of this more often? Everything I did revolved around it. My jobs were menial jobs. I would do menial jobs so I could get some money. You know, I don't mean if there's any waiters in here, but jobs where they pay you cash. So at the end of the day, you could go drink with that cash because I would spend all that money. You know, God forbid you pay. I love the treatment centers. They want to teach us about our triggers. Payday was always my trigger. Monday through Friday, you know, I'm that's it. I'm going to pay the rent, pay the light bill. I swear to God, I'm going to get some food in this house. And I'm just turning my life around. As soon as they put that money in my hand, something would happen. Well, you know what? Who the hell needs electricity anyway? It pissed me off to pay for electricity I already used. That's really the truth. Some of us are really, you know, I do have a home group, and my home group is Life's a Beach. We meet on A1A in Palm Coast, Florida, 7 o'clock on Sunday night. It is a wonderful group. I love the people, and there are some people here from that group. And my sobriety date is September 12th, 1990. Hey, please. I'm like the guy, you know, make coffee, will you? But I don't remember a lot about September 12th, 1990. That was the day I made the phone call, but I really don't remember a heck of a lot about that day. I remember a hell of a lot about September 11th, 1990. worst day of my life. And on September 11th, let me tell you what happened. I didn't plan to be this guy. I didn't plan to end up like that. If you're like me, I swear, I never got up in the morning and said to myself, today I'm going to put a flamethrower in my life. I'm going to burn my life to the ground. I woke up every day, as feeble an attempt as I would make, but I woke up every day and said, today I'm going to be as happy and as successful as I can possibly manage to be today. And on September 11th, 1990, this is what my best effort got me. I was in a Skid Row motel room in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, with my two-year-old son and his mother. I was unemployable, and we were in total poverty. As a matter of fact, if the authorities would have walked in there, they probably would have arrested me for the sight they saw in that room. And prior to that day, things had, this was really the end of my drinking, but prior to that, for about 6 months prior to that, I would do what we always do. I would succumb to the drink, enter the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to do it again. But think back, you know, at the end it really got bad. Maybe you've had this feeling, I don't know, but this is what it was like for me. There was nothing worse than cracking your eyelids open after a binge. I would crack my eyelids open, and the first thought that would cross my mind was, damn, I'm not dead. And then the horror, the guilt, the shame would all be on me. And I would do the alcoholic dance. That's it. I'm done. I'm not doing this again. I can't live like this anymore. I swear to God, I'm not going to do this anymore. And I would say, today I'm going to get a job. Today I'm going to be a dad. Today I'm going to grow up. I'm going to be responsible. I'm going to put some food in this house. And I meant it. I'd look at my little boy and I'd cry real tears. And I meant it with all my heart. Some days I would even go down and get a newspaper to look for a job. And I'd open that newspaper. And the problem was is that, and I remember here in Clancy back in 1991 in Daytona Beach at what started as this conference. And I remember when he first said that my problem wasn't alcohol. And it knocked me off my chair. I was 3 weeks sober. My sponsor took me to this conference, paid for the room, and brought me to a conference. And it was just like this. Clean, dressed up people, looked nice. I said, where's the alcoholics? And I heard that description that finally made sense to me. See, my problem was never the alcohol or the drugs. My problem was untreated sobriety. And I would wake up, and here's the problem. I would wake up, and I meant it. I'm going to get a job. I swear to God, I'm going to turn my life around. I'd go get a newspaper. I'd start looking through the paper, but here's what would happen. And early on in my drinking, it talks about it in the book. It says there's a point in our drinking, in the drinking of every alcoholic, where he could stop or moderate, but he just doesn't want to. See, I never wanted to. I always thought I could. The great obsession was that I could beat the game, that I could control this thing, that I could drink like normal people. And I would start looking through the newspaper, and all of a sudden I would get that sense of disapproval, that terminal sense of lack, that terrible, and the guilt and shame where my life had brought me. And I'd look at my little boy, and I would cry, and it was absolutely overwhelming. And I would do one of these. I'd go, you know, oh hell, all the good jobs are taken. You know, tomorrow morning I'm going to get up real early. I just need two drinks. I'm going to go get two beers. I'm going to find a way to get two beers. I'm going to drink those beers. And in as bad a situation as I was in, I would drink those two beers. And I guzzled them because I'm not drinking for taste. I never drank for the taste as long as I can remember. I drank for the effect. And I would guzzle those two beers. And then here's what I would say. Oh, what was I worried about? Things aren't that bad. And I meant it. Now, the difference between that 6 months prior to September 11th and September 11th was this. I woke up on September 11th, cracked my eyelids open. Damn, I'm not dead. I can't do this anymore. And I'm going to turn my life around. I'm going to go get a job. I'm going to be a dad. I'm going to straighten my life out. And some thing inside of me went, no, you're not. You're not going to do any of that. You're going to die an alcoholic. Whether it's in the gutter, whether it's in jail, you're going to die this way. And for the first time in my life, I couldn't buy my own BS. The part that Carol read in the book, Quicksand Stretched Out, alcohol was my master. Bill says, right before that, here's what Bill says. See, I didn't surrender to get sober. I surrendered to die of this disease on that day. And Bill said, so I was to join the endless procession of sots that had gone on before me. And that's exactly what I said, just in a little bit more modern language. So I'm going to die in the gutter. So I'm a drunk. So this is it. This is how it all ends. And I knew it that day. And that day I sat there in my guilt, my shame, drinking, and I had an epiphany. I like to call it my reverse spiritual awakening. What happened was, is I saw my life through your eyes. And I could not. It's unbelievably painful, is what it says in the 12 and 12. When all of a sudden we get a view of what my life had become without the benefit of alcohol, drugs, rationalization, justification, or minimization. And all of a sudden I saw my life exactly the way you would see it. And the horror was upon me that day. And I had a great discovery. I said, here's my problem. It's not alcohol and drugs. I knew that day it was not alcohol was not my problem. Not enough alcohol was my problem. See, if I could have just stayed drunk, I would have been okay. I wouldn't be here. The problem is I had to sober up. It's physically impossible to stay drunk. And when you sober up, reality is on you. Sobriety is on you. And it was absolutely unbearable in those last days. And that day I made a decision. I said, today I'm going to quit quitting. I thought it was brilliant. I said, no more guilt. I'm done. I'm done quitting. This is who I am. I'm going to be a drunk for the rest of my life. And this is the way I'm going to die. And I said, from now on, I am going to do whatever it takes. No holds barred. And I tell guys this a lot of times when I sponsor them, when we start to go through the steps. And we say, well, I want you to lay aside everything you think you know about God. Just till we finish this process. And then we can go back and pick up what seems to work with what you've discovered here. Because if there is a God, I want you to discover it. Quit telling God who He is. Let's see who He tells you He is. Let's find out. And I said, this is going to be the most courageous thing that you do in your life. And that day, I made a decision I was going to go to any length. And I tell them this, when guys I sponsor, I say, and if there is no God, then we may as well buy a gun and start holding up liquor stores. Okay? Because there's no reason. Let's go back to do what we were doing. And that day I made a decision I'm going to do whatever it takes to stay drunk for the rest of my life, for as long as I can, till it ends. And I was drinking for the end. Now that's where I took my life. That's where my best thinking, my best ability to stay sober, to try and live happily and successfully every day, that's where it took me on September 11th, 1990. Now here's what happened. There was a knock on that motel room door that night. And you know as well as I do, at this stage of your drinking, you do not open the door. There's no good news out there. Okay? Publishers Clearinghouse is not out there with the big check and the balloons. As a matter of fact, there's tape over the peephole. Okay? The phone's gone. That was gone a long time ago because every time you hear a phone ring, you have a coronary. But that night, I opened the door. And you know, for years after I got sober, I tried to figure out, why did I open the door that night? I know I don't open the door. No light could escape. I had the windows sealed up. It was like a black hole in this motel room. Why did I open the door that night? And finally it dawned on me, years later, The reason I opened that door is because I had nothing left to lose. I didn't have to pretend to be anything else anymore. There was a freedom in it. There was an absolute freedom in the acceptance of what happened to me. And I believe that that's... And I'm supposed to talk about step one and step two. I figure I'll do that later on tonight. No, I'm kidding. I'm just, I kind of believe that we all did step one and step two before we ever got here. I think what I had to have is a guy like Bob or Clancy or Sandy. Somebody explained to me what happened. It's like being in a car accident and coming to. So what the hell happened? Well, let me tell you, kid. Let me tell you what happened to you. And that's what my sponsor did for me. He explained to me what happened. What happened to your life? Let's take a look at your relationship with the alcohol. Let's see what you were willing to pay for this stuff. In the 12 and 12, it says that in the first two steps, we're engaged in reflection. It says, these conclusions do not require any action. They only require acceptance. But later on, it says they require 100% acceptance. No lurking notion, no reservation. And I'm one of those guys that give as much acceptance as I need to. But that day, I answered the door. There was a knock on the door. I opened the door, and my brother came in. I hadn't seen my brother in a while, and he walked in, and I was speechless. Of course, I was buzzed, and I was drunk, and I'm sitting there in a stupor, and my little boy is running around in filthy diapers with a bottle that had milk in it at one time, but it was just cloudy water. And he took one look, and I saw the horror in his eyes. And he didn't say anything. He didn't yell at me. He didn't tell me what a low life I was. He just wrote down his phone number. He said, if you want help, I'll watch your son while you get help. And he turned around and he walked out. 2 minutes earlier, I made a decision to drink till I died. September 12, 1990, I've made that phone call. You go figure. Had nothing to do with me, I don't believe. And sobriety has been a thrill. It's been a journey. I'd like to tell you it's all been wonderful. And if you look at my wife, you would think it's all been wonderful. But Tammy's my present wife. What you don't know is she was also my previous wife. This is my second and third wife. Some are sicker than others, okay? And I don't blame her. What happened to me is I ended up shortly after that in a treatment center for indigents in Miami. And went through this six-month treatment center, and that's where I got introduced to you. Now, this was 5 days before my 40th birthday. I had never been to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I didn't know anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had never been to a detox. I had never been to a treatment center. The delusion was so set in me that I had no clue that there was any other way out. I was going to take this thing to the bitter end. To go on to the bitter end, trying to blot out the consciousness of our intolerable... I was a bitter ender. Didn't know that, but that's what I was. And he took me in this treatment center. It was a six-month treatment center. And the first night I was there, they brought a young man in. And it was my 40th birthday, September 17th, 1990. And they brought this guy in. He was a 28-year-old kid. He came in and he was dressed nice. He had clean pants with creases in them. He drove up in a car. It was a Friday night. And I'm thinking, what are they paying this guy to be here on a Friday night? I bet I could do this gig, you know. And get clean clothes and he had everything I wanted. He had a full pack of Marlboro Reds and a watch. You know? Because I thought, if I get that watch, I'll be out of here. And he brought in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And during that meeting, he said a few things that I didn't agree with. This is not controversial. I just didn't, in my profound intelligence at that point, I didn't agree with. He said, one of the things he said was, you never have to take another drink or drug if you don't want to. And I knew that was crap because I had not wanted to for a long time. But he said something and he set the hook. He said, you never have to feel the way you feel tonight again. And I would have done anything in the world. I was in a treatment center for indigents and I would have traded... places with any of the 50 people in that treatment center. I would have traded lives right then and there. And he also said at the end of the 6 months, there won't be five of you left. And he was right. There were two of us left. And I don't know why I was one, but I am. I think that comes with obligation for all of us. I think if you're in this room, it comes with obligation. The odds are against us. And we're here. And we really didn't do anything to get here. Really. It's almost like a dog, a little puppy. Some big hand comes down and grabs me by the scruff of the neck, takes me out of harm's way. It's kind of what I look back. It's what it feels like in my life. I got out of that treatment center, and I went to, I couldn't go back to my girlfriend and my son, but my parents had set them up in an apartment, and they had moved to a little town in central Florida, Lady Lake, Florida. There was no villages. You all know what the villages are, right? There was no villages. It was... I'm not going to say it. What does it say in the book? There's a line about the villages in the book, isn't there? It says, retired businessmen lulling in the Florida sunshine. There they are! That's them. Complaining about the state of the nation. Oh my God! That's them. Denny? I'm just making an observation. It's probably wrong. But anyway, I got out of that treatment center and I went where every good 40-year-old alcoholic goes. Mom, I'm home. God, we're pitiful. And I got 6 months sober, Ma, you know. And she bought, they bought a little a home to come down, you know, in the winter. It's what they call a manufactured home. It's kind of halfway between a house and a trailer. I called it Mom's halfway house. And I moved in and started. And I was sitting there the very first night I got there. And you know, this is the magic of these rooms. I'm going to tell you this. This is. We talk about this in meetings, and I may be wrong, but everybody goes, "Let's don't leave till the miracle happens." I got to tell you, if you're here, I think the miracle happened. I just think you're the last one to know. Right? You have a sponsor that points it out to you. My sponsor told me, he said, "You wouldn't know a miracle if it hit you in the name of the Father." And I wouldn't. But if you're here, and I tell new guys that all the time. If you're here, stop buying lotto tickets. You won. Now, you don't get the lump sum. You get the installments for the rest of your life. And I was sitting out on the front porch that night, or whatever you want to call it, and there was an old man next door watering his lawn. And this old man, I'm going to get to step one and step two, I promise. This old man was watering his lawn, and he kind of moseyed on over. And I could tell, you know, he was kind of attracted to me. And and all of a sudden he said, "Hey, kid, I hear you had a problem with alcohol and drugs." And I said, "Oh, Mom's been talking." He said, "Listen, do you want to go to an AA meeting tonight?" "Sure." He said, "I'll pick you up at 7:15. He introduced himself. His name was Frank. He was a retired postman. And Frank... And now, we don't mention this a lot, but I swear we used to mention it a lot back then in the meetings. And I'm going to describe it, and you tell me what it sounds like. That man, at 7:15, I looked out the window, and that little guy was out there. Now, by the way, that old man, he's my age. He's the age I am now. And I looked outside, and he sat out there with the car idling. He never beeped the horn, and he just waited. And I got out, I went out, got into his car. I smoked all his cigarettes, burned up his gas. And on the way home, I said, "Can you stop there at the 7-Eleven? I want to buy some lotto tickets. And if I win, I'm going to do good things." I know you newcomers have already made that promise, right? "We're going to build halfway houses and treatment centers. If just let me win, God, okay?" And The next night, I was having dinner. He brought me back home. The next night, I was having dinner and looking over my mother's shoulder, and there's that little car sitting outside there idling. Now, I was really ticked off because I missed the part about us going steady. And he never beeped the horn. He sat there waiting, and I said, I can outwait this old guy. I bet I can take him. And I couldn't. I got so uncomfortable, I had to go out. I walked out, and I got into his car, and we drove off to a meeting. You know what that's called? Unconditional love. The kindness of strangers. A lot of us are here because of the kindness of strangers. Somebody did that for us. I thought he liked me. I remember I told him when I got a car, I said, Frank, I won't be needing rides to meeting anymore. I got a car. He goes, oh, I got to find another idiot to fill that seat. He did say that, too. I called him tonight, too. I told him about all you guys that are here, and I said, Frank, I got to give a talk in front of these guys that have been, I've heard them for 20 years. He said, don't screw up. Thanks for the encouragement. And Frank proceeded to take me to meetings every night. We drove to meetings, and we were on the circuit. There was meetings back then. There weren't meetings around. We'd drive to Ocala. It'd be an hour each way. And we'd drive to Eustis, and we'd drive all these places. And sometimes it was an hour, 45 minutes each way. And Frank wasn't a guy who could quote the big book. Frank was a big book liver, not a big book thumper. Frank never went to a meeting without a dummy in his car. And as a matter of fact, I used to have to race out after the meeting so I could get the front seat. Because there were always these new guys. And Frank started to talk to me about step one and step two in that car. And all the time that we spent. He took me to a conference just like this, 3 weeks out of that treatment center. And he paid for the room, brought me there, and fed me that weekend. Here's what he told me. I love that man. He's still my sponsor today, by the way. I talked to him this morning. I talked to him almost every day. The relationship has changed somewhat. He's kind of more like a father than anything, but in the same respect, I listen to what he says. He's a man that I became willing to accept his observations on my life more than my observations on my life, even when I didn't agree with them. He was the first person I ever had an honest relationship with. I can tell you honestly, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, there's two things I never remember saying. One was I lied. The other was I'm wrong. I don't ever remember those things leaving my lips. If I got caught in a lie, it was just an occasion to lie more or swear to it. And get angry, you know. Frank started to talk to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. He started to talk to me about this program. He said something to me one time. We were talking about step one, and we started in through the book. He took me through the steps, and he started talking to me about step one. Here's what he told me about step one. He said, now this is going to sound confusing, because it confused me. He said, if you're not 100% sure you will drink again, you will drink again. I went, what? What the heck does that mean? He said, believe me, this is a fatal deal. If you're not 100% sure you're dying from this thing and you will die, you won't do what it takes. He said, and I said, and then we would hear things in meetings. I'd come out of a meeting. I'd say, 90 meetings in 90 days? Are they out of their mind? He goes, don't pay any attention. That's a load of crap. He said, you're much sicker. You're going to need 180 in 90 days. And he had a way of just kind of guiding me. But what Frank did was, Frank was a signpost. He always directed me to God. Everything he did after I grasped that first step. We started talking about that step. You know, Frank put it in a way. He said, let me explain step one and step two in a language you can understand. Step one is you're screwed. That's it. Bad news. I said, what? He says, yeah, if you're not sure you'll drink again, you'll drink again. It talks about it in the book. It says, On Roman numeral, in the doctor's opinion, Roman numeral 30, here's what it says. It says, much has been written pro and con, but among physicians, not knuckleheads, among physicians, learned men, the general opinion seems to be that most alcoholics, most chronic alcoholics, are screwed. Now, they said doomed, but that's because they didn't use screwed back then. They would have said it if they had the word. And over and over in the book, it tells me that. And it says, in one of the stories, it says, my friends prophesied that if I had an alcoholic mind, the day would come when I would drink again. Kreskin says he's going to drink again, except for divine help. So Frank would convince, he spent so much time convincing me, he says, you're right. And I remember, and he started talking about the phenomenon of craving, and we started exploring, looking back in my life with that reflection. And I remember early on, before I knew, I took a few jobs. I remember one time I lost 3 jobs in a row as a bartender in a very short period. And the reason I took the bartending job is you get cash and you can drink. What's better than that? And usually women are in the bar, so... But what would happen is I'd get to work and I'd take a drink, and the next thing you know, the boss is yelling at me saying, get back behind the bar. See, because I'm the type of alcoholic, when I drink, I don't work. I can only do one thing at a time. And then finally, after the 3rd job I lost, I figured it out. I go, okay, I'm not going to drink until 15 minutes before closing. Bingo! Right? Doesn't that, it works. Now, that's when I still had some kind of control, and I still had a little bit of a brain left, but little by little that doesn't stay like that. We start to cross this line where we lose all control. My son was born in 1988, and things were getting pretty bad with me. And I remember when I found out my son was going to be born, I was excited. I thought maybe this baby will straighten me out, right? Maybe this little boy will straighten me out. In a kind of a crazy way, I always wanted to be a dad. I went to the hospital when my little boy was born, and I absolutely fell madly head over heels in love with that little boy. It's like somebody hit a light switch in my life. And I knew that there was another human being in this world for the first time that I loved more than anything, that I would lay down in front of a bus for. And I held that little boy, and I made all the promises every dad makes. I'm going to love you. We're going to be able to walk down the street arm in arm. I'm going to coach you in Little League and in baseball and basketball, football. We're going to have such a great life together. And I meant it. And I laid that little boy back down in the nursery, and I walked into the waiting room, and there were some friends there, and they said, let's have a drink to celebrate the birth of your child. 8 days later, I don't even know how he got home from the hospital. I didn't want to do that. I loved that little boy. But nothing is more important than when I drink. That phenomenon of craving kicks in. We're not drinking to escape. We're drinking to overcome a craving. And I didn't know it. And here's the reason I don't know it. Because it looks like I changed my mind. See, the phenomenon of craving, I thought that what that was is a guy sitting under a bridge shaking, going, I need another drink. Now, it is that. But here's what it looked like in my life. I'll have another. That's all. I'll have another. You know? That's what I did over and over again. Now, that physical aspect of the disease, I believe that's kind of what it says in step one with we're powerless over alcohol. For me, it kind of addresses the physical aspect of this illness. And then the second half of that statement, step one, says that our lives have become unmanageable. I think that addresses the insanity in my life. The mental aspect. Page 22 says, and one of my favorite pages, along with the other 163, page 22 says, why does he behave like this? When one drink leads to another debacle with all its attendant suffering and humiliation, why does he take that first drink? Why can't he stay sober? By the way, the other thing that always puzzled me, they talk about alcoholic suffering. Bill calls us sufferers. And I thought that an alcoholic suffering was when you're drunk and sick. And it may be that. But alcoholic torture to me is when I crack my eyelids open sober. That's alcoholic torture. That's the reason I got drunk again. It's because I found myself sober one more time. That was enough reason to drink again. So it says, and then it gives us the answer in the very next paragraph. I never noticed this for years. Because, of course, Frank was always trying to get me to read this book. Read this book. I told him, I'm not a reader. Yeah. And so he would say, in the next paragraph, it gives us the answer. You know what it says? There will never be an answer to this riddle. Stop trying to figure it out. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? Bill talks about. I was trying to figure it out. I'm not going to do this till I can figure it out. The obsession that one day I will beat the game. That I will be able to control and enjoy my drinking. And here's what he said to me. He says, when are you going to start or stop trying to cure your alcoholism by pretending you're not an alcoholic? And I said, what? He said, why don't you just accept that you are an alcoholic and you will start doing things that you have to do to live? That acceptance. And then it talks about, because if that was the only problem, was the physical aspect, then all we got to do is just say no. How'd that work out for you? Didn't work out for me at all. It says the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind, and here's that problem. In step two, in the 12 and 12, Bill says, most of us are willing to admit that we are problem drinkers, but we have difficulty admitting that we're mentally ill. Oop. I'm just mean me. I don't mean you. But the relief came when I knew it. And here's the tricky part. I'm going to tell you the tricky part. I had a very difficult time with step one, part B, admitting I was mentally ill. I knew my life was unmanageable, and I ran my life into the ground again at 5.5 years sober because I thought my life was unmanageable because I drank. And I had to run my life into the ground sober to find out that it's unmanageable by me. See, the number one symptom of mental illness is you don't know you have it. You guys sound smart to you. I'm taking meetings into the detox every week. You should hear the brainstorms they come up with. Right? When I get out of here, I'm stopping by the bar to tell the guy I will not be spending any more money. Now, I understand that kind of thinking. So, but that's the problem. I started to build a life back up. Frank got, and then we started to get into step two with Frank, and I had a little issue with God. It's not that I didn't believe in God. I was too much of a coward to not believe in God. I was going to hedge my bet, okay? In case there is a God, I believe in Him. But I live my life like He's not looking. You know, kind of like, God, Halley's Comet, look over there. And I would be off, you know. It sounds crazy, but I really did. If you asked me, do you believe in God? I would tell you yes, but of course He had zero influence in my life. Frank used to say, if I followed you around with a video camera, could I take that CD to court and convict you of being a good member of AA? Oh, how many hours of the day? You mean all the hours? So as we started, you know, and we'd go to meetings. He set me free in so many ways. Step two does not really talk about God, in case you hadn't noticed. It only mentions a power greater than you. And it says that this is it talked about, yes, we have a substitute, and it's vastly more than that. And I started off, my first substitute was Frank. I would go to Frank. I mean, I came here with felonies. I hadn't paid the IRS in 20 years. I had child support. I had kids that I'd lost. And my life was a total wreck. I was 40 years old. And I would go to Frank. I would wake up, the horror would be on me sober. And I'd go to Frank. Frank, what's the use? And he would look at me and he'd say, it's going to be all right. Oh, is it? Oh, thank God. I was worried. His opinion of my life was a lot better than mine. And Frank would tell me, and we'd go to meetings, and he would start talking about God. He said, by the way, in step two, he says, it's not necessary to believe in God. Here's what we're going to do. We're just going to start living like you believe in God and see what happens. Let's see what shows up. Let's start working through some working and guiding our life by some principles. And those are the rest of the steps. And he painted me a picture. He said, when he told me, he says, "You're step one, you're screwed. No way out, you're doomed." I go, "Well, that's not good news." I said, "Sounds like it's going to take a friggin' miracle." He said, "That's step two." And it is. That's what it is. You don't get the miracle, but you know that's what it's going to take. That's all it is. You know, I know it's going to take one. It's kind of like, and you become willing as only the dying are willing to be. See, that's why step one is so paramount. And for me, I have to stay current with step one. Because I'll forget. Because I really sound smart now. You know? And I'm asking my wife. I'm just looking at her face. So Frank would tell me, he said, "Here's what I want you to imagine, step one and step two." Because they're so closely joined. I'm glad I get to talk about them both because they really, you almost can't have one without the other. You put a gun to my head, I'm going to pray. That's it, I'm going to hope for a miracle. He said, "Pretend you're in the middle of the ocean. You're treading water. You can tread water for a while, but you're going down. Sooner or later, you're going down. And if you're truthful to yourself, you'll know there's only one way to get out of this situation. It's going to take a power greater than you." Now, of course, we're hoping for the helicopter, the Coast Guard to come by in a ship or a boat or a helicopter or the cruise ship, somebody to come by. But here's what really happens. If you didn't know you were absolutely dying, here's what really happens. Some dummy, some retired mailman named Frank comes swimming by doing the side stroke. And you're in the middle of the ocean. And he's calm and at peace. And he says, "Follow me." And you go, hey, how do we get out of here? "Follow me." There's no land in sight. What is this guy seeing? Because this is spiritual. It's not linear. It doesn't equate in the material world. Bill calls us worldly a bunch of times in the big book. You know why? It says, and here's the definition of worldly. More concerned with material things than spiritual things. And we are. And I was at a conference one time. I heard a guy give a talk on the varieties of religious experience. Thank God he did, because I wouldn't know what's in that damn book. I've tried to read it a bunch of times. Usually 3 in the morning when I can't sleep. What he said is he was talking about the type of religion that he said, and one of his observations were that there are people that they call once born people. Those are normal people. They can get along with 1 foot in the material world, 1 foot in the spiritual world. They go to work every day. They go to church. They raise their kids. They're happy and comfortable in a normal life. And then they talk about the twice born people. And that's me. That's alcoholics. We have to be born. We are so rooted in the material world that until it's absolutely destroyed, we can't be in both. We only can be in one. Take your choice. And that's the great destination of step one and step two. That's the conclusion that I arrived at. Die an alcoholic death, step one, or live by spiritual principles. Now, why are these not easy alternatives? Because spiritual life looks like shuffleboard and bingo forever. So, it's not... It would be easy for anybody else, normal, but we're looking for angles here. You know? It's like Roland Hazard when he went and saw Carl Jung and he says... What's the after he came back after he relapsed and the best psychologist in the world gives him his diagnosis. Here's what our diagnosis is. Go find God. That's all you got. That the best you got? Go find God. I was at work one day and Frank, and we were going in this process of step two and the awakenings that come with it. And I was working selling cars at a car lot and my boss was a guy that I used to party with when I drank. And he had he was going out one night and I didn't tell Frank. I figured I'll go to Orlando, right here in Orlando. And I was living in Lady Lake about 50 miles away. He said, "Come on." I said, "Well, I'm only going to listen to the music, right? What could happen?" And I'll tell you, I believe that once you resign to this, I believe you're given an opportunity to grow your faith. What we have is we don't have a monopoly on how one can acquire faith, is what the book says. We have an approach that works for us. And I believe that my Father gives me opportunities to grow my faith, to strengthen it. And this was one of those Bill W. moments. You know, he's walking in the hotel lobby, go to the bar, go to the phone booth. The phone booth, what's on the other end of the phone booth? A drunk? The bar is relief. And I've been a relief-seeking missile my whole life. It doesn't make sense. So I go out with Tony one night. And we're in Orlando, and we're drinking in a place I shouldn't be at. I'm sober probably 8 months. And he is loaded. And I'm starting to get real squirrely. And I said, you got to take me home. And he's drunk. He's not taking me home. We're in a place he does not want to leave. Okay? There were scantily clad women in this place. He's not leaving to take me home 50 miles. So, and I'm getting panicky. And I said, you got to take... And we end up having a big fight. Now, this is my boss. And you know, when you have a problem with the boss, you're the problem. In case you didn't know that. So he takes me, he ends up staying there. I end up taking a taxi all the way back, and I take it back to Lady Lake, and I get out of the cab, and the next day I show up for work. And I was a little timid, and I knew he was going to be embarrassed because he showed his behind. You know how we do, right? And I'm sitting in my little cubicle, and all of a sudden I hear Joe Krogan come to the office. So I walk down to the office, and he says, have a seat. And I sat down, and he said, I know you go to those AA meetings. I said, yeah. He said, tell me the truth. Do you talk about me there? Now, I didn't then. I do now. So, this was one of those moments. I have no idea. I'm afraid to make a decision on my own at this time. And I believe that my life is saved because of a firm foundation in step one, because of Frank. But I run back to my office and I get on the phone. I go, Frank, you won't believe it. This guy thinks we talk about him in AA. I am screwed. I need this job. I got child support. I got these felonies that I got to take care of. I'm living with mom in a trailer. You know. And Frank goes, this is wonderful. He says, here's what I want you to do. I want you to pray about it and let me know how God works it out. True story. That was his best advice. If I would have had another alternative, I would have done it. Trust me. I didn't. And I show up for work the next day. And here comes Tony's car on a tow truck, towing it in. It's riddled with bullet holes. He had got shot 8 times the night before trying to buy crack cocaine. Now, it's a merciful God. It was a small caliber gun. He wasn't hurt bad, okay? But, true, but I never saw Tony again. So, I mean, he lost his job. He was gone. I run to the office, call Frank. Frank, you won't believe it. God shot the guy 8 times. So... Anyway, that was my exposure to you. He had a lot of great things to tell me, too. He said, I want you to just pretend you're dumb, because he knew it would offend my ego. And then he would say, just long enough until you know you are. But like I told you, I wish everything would have been wonderful, and I proceeded to go through the rest of the steps. And I'm going to tell you what, you take the alcohol out of my life, things started to get better fast. I met my beautiful wife. She worked at Intergroup with my sponsor, Frank. We fell madly in love, so I thought it was okay. You know, it's sanctioned by the Pope. We're going to be okay. Frank's blessed this relationship. We're madly in love. One of the members of my home group was a minister. He married us. We went to counseling with him. He sat there in front of her and said, do not marry this man. Swear. I didn't pay him just because of that. So But we get married. She's got kids. I've got my son back. After a year, I got custody of my son. I was praying for God to teach me how to love like Frank. And I got custody of my son. Another one of those opportunities that just present himself. And we started to form a family. And I end up getting a great career opportunity. And we have to move. And I uproot her family, my son, and leave all the men that I know in recovery. We moved down to West Palm Beach. It's the best job I ever had in my life. And I'm not getting to meetings very often. I'm not calling my sponsor. I don't have one down there. I'm a pretty busy guy. On page 66, here's what it says. The alcoholic insanity returns, and then we drink again. My problem never was the alcohol. The alcohol is the solution to my insanity, living with the way I live. I became somebody else. I was doing things in this marriage. See, what I brought was, I thought that now that I was sober, I was capable, I was qualified to be in a relationship. I was qualified to be a dad. I was qualified to be a friend, an employee, you know, and I was wrong. I was now qualified to learn how to do all those things. And it's a painful process. I know that. It is a painful process. If you're new, but you don't have to do it alone. Believe me, and it strengthens you. Every one of those things will make you stronger, more useful, give you more purpose in your life. And I was doing things in that marriage, and I was not the same guy. The fight started. Tammy and I were, and I was dishonest. I was hiding money. It was 50%. It was a 50-50 relationship, but my 50% looked like this, and hers looked like that. And I was telling somebody one time, and I've always been like that. When I was a little kid, my grandmother would give my brother and I, he was my younger brother, a Snicker bar. And she'd say, "You're the oldest. Cut it in half." I could not get my hand to the middle of that candy bar, no matter how hard I tried. And then I would spend the next 20 minutes explaining to him that these are equal. Well, what happened was it got so mad that finally she couldn't take it anymore, and she divorced me, threw me out of the house. How dare her? And it was the house we bought with her divorce money. And it affected me so badly, the rage and the anger. The insecurity was absolutely out of control. I wasn't going to meetings. I was hitting meeting here and there. It affected my work, and within 2 months, they fired me from the best job I ever had. And I'm 5.5 years sober. Now I'm divorced, stone cold sober. And I'm fired from the best job I ever had, stone cold sober. And I got my little boy, and I can't sleep, and I can't eat. I'm so angry, and I'm so mad at God. And one day, I'm driving down the street, and I see, and I go by this bar, and it really caught my eye. It was very attractive. I said, if I ever go back out, I'm going to go drinking in there. It had a name that I was real attracted to. It said Bar. True. And it had the parking lot in the back, and it opened at 8 in the morning. I said, I could be a big shot in there for a while. They'll catch on. They always catch on. Guys like me can't stand still. I got to keep moving. I had burned my life to the ground, absolutely sober. I circled that bar like a buzzard circling a carcass for 7 days. I would drive by that bar. But it's hard to drink when you got 5.5 years sober. Every time I went by, the butterflies would come in my stomach. See, because I don't know about you, but I'm the type of alcoholic, when I drink, my lifestyle changes. There's no more illusion that I will be drinking out of stemmed glassware at the piano bar. I may have glass stemware, but it won't be at the piano bar. And what happened was, is on day 7, I couldn't sleep anymore. I was so angry, I finally cursed God. My little boy was asleep in the back room. I got up, and I left him alone. He was 6 years old. I left him alone in that apartment, and I drove across town to this bar. And I made up my mind, I'm going to drink, and I don't care. I cannot. If this is sobriety, you can have it. I didn't know that wasn't. That was just abstinence. And I was one block away from the bar. I could see it. I had the butterflies in my stomach because I know my life is about to get burned to the ground. And I look over, and underneath the streetlight is a broken down van with its hood up. And the front license plate said, and I can see it right now, "Have you prayed today?" And like an idiot, I said the Serenity Prayer. That was my moment in the hotel lobby. And I ended up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous I'd been to one time before, a year earlier. And I walked in the back of the room. And there was about 150 people at this meeting. And the guy was at a podium. And he said, "We're celebrating anniversaries. We have about 6 celebrants. Is there anyone else here celebrating an anniversary in the month of September?" I said, "I am." And I raised my hand. And he said, "Great, what we do is we all come up and share for about 5-10 minutes on how we did it. Since we have a visitor, why don't you start us off?" I was going to tell him how I did it. Well, I got to the bar, and and suddenly, no. And I walked up to the front of the room, and I got to the podium, and I turned around, and I looked at your faces. And I couldn't talk. All I could do was cry. I started sobbing. I said, "I need help. I'm lost and I can't do this anymore." And the treatment center had brought a bunch of people from and they were all in the front row. And so I was sitting there sobbing. So they rushed me off the stage. They said, "That's not how it is at 6 years sober. He's just humble." And 3 guys took me in the kitchen. Poured a cup of coffee, and it's just like the old joke, "We're going to show you one more time." And they were at my house at 7:30 the next morning. They stayed with me till 11:30 that night, and they began to be with me and listen to me moan and bellyache. They took me into the treatment centers and the detoxes, and I became willing that moment to surrender the rest of my life. I finally realized what my life being unmanageable truly meant. That I can't do this, that I am going to have a power greater than myself in my life, in every area of my life. I'm one of the lucky ones. That's what happened to me. And I threw myself back into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to treatment centers, detoxes. I started sponsoring guys, taking meetings into the prisons. These guys, my life started to change. And I made a decision based on someone else's welfare. I didn't want to go back to the business I was in because it's 14-hour days and I have my little boy. And I said, "I'm going to start with where I'm at. I'm going to be a successful member of Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm going to be a successful dad." And today most of my relationships are successful. What I mean by successful is that I'm better because I'm in them. We're better because we're in this together. Aren't we? That's how it works. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts. We're better together than we are alone. And I knew I didn't have to be alone anymore. I need you way more than you need me. And about 1.5 years later, my wife and I started to date again. We hadn't seen each other. She had done exactly the same, threw herself back into the program. We got together and we said, "We can't have a successful relationship without God's help. I mean, if He's the one that's got to take away the resentments, the selfishness, the fear, the alcohol, I guess He can handle all the rest." And so every morning we pray together. We pray for our marriage. We take time together and pray because we can't do it on our own. I've already had to pick up a white chip in marriage. So I'm going to close. I'm going to tell you a little story. Next Friday, actually, one year ago, on May 7th, I got a phone call. It was a Sunday night. It was the cold. If you remember, if you lived in Florida, it was one of the coldest, rainiest months we've ever had. And it was terrible. And I got a phone call from my son, who had been thrown out of his 4th halfway house and one treatment center. And he was on the street. And it was about 9 o'clock at night. And that's that little boy. And it broke my heart. And he said, "Dad, I'm ready. I need help." And I said, "Son, I've been throwing thousands of dollars at your illness this past year, and it's worse. It's not better." I said, "I can't help you." I said, "You're going to have to do what I did. You're going to go have to find the kindness of strangers. You're going to have to walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope you find what I found there. I hope you find Frank. I hope you find the men that I found." And I hung up the phone. And the next couple of days, all I did was bellyache, and I called a couple of friends of mine because I wanted them to feel sorry for me, because this was the most painful thing in my life. And 2 days later, I got a call from a friend of mine that some of us know here. He's up in Maryland. I had called him, bellyache to him, and he says, "Why don't you give me your son's phone number? Let me see if I can reach out to him." It's funny, we can be on the street, but we still got a smartphone, right? So he called me back 2 days later, and he said, "And you saw my son in Philly when we were up there." And he said, "Your son, by the way, I'm just letting you know, your son's getting on a plane today. He's going to fly up to Maryland. He's going to live in my basement, and I'm going to take him through the steps." And I said, "At least let me pay you for the plane fare." He said, "No, he'll pay me back." And he's been there almost a year. Next Friday, he called me. He said, and back there, they have a different tradition. What they do is they don't speak on their year. They invite the speaker. He said, "Dad, would you come up and speak on my one-year anniversary?" So my whole family is flying up there, and we're going to, if he makes it, it's another friggin' week. Thank you for being there for me, but more important, thank you for being there for him. I love you.